This is Uncle Don here again on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. This is the 308th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. And now for this week's good cheer. As I approach my 69th birthday, I'm comforted by the fact that one fine day I may drop in my tracks and all my petty concerns will be washed away. That's the way all the men in my family expired, except for my brother, who was murdered. When dead, I don't expect to go anywhere, as there will no longer be any me. I will expire like a blown candle's flame, kaput. That's a daunting thought, one that we humans have trouble wrapping our transient minds around. Disbelief in death is the root of belief in everlasting life, the foundation of most Western religions. There's only one loophole in the comfort offered by eventual expiration. This is a fate left to those who have been, or appear to have been, too pure in their corporeal lives. The Roman Catholic Church has a long history of meddling with the dead, doing some spiritual grave robbing in search of new recruits to its stable of saints. For those accused of perfection, death is no shield to resurrection to these ranks. Sainthood is a growth industry under today's Pope and his predecessor. Every appointed saint is assigned a crew of the faithful, as each becomes a patron of one splinter group or another. No specialty is immune from having a patron saint, and in today's changing economy, creating new occupations spurs demand for ever more canonizations. Suppose after my death some future pope is apprised of the need for a patron saint of condom recyclers. None of the current crew will accept the assignment, so a recruit is sought. St. Peter has been surfing the internet, running across archived Uncle Don shows on radioforall.net, and detects a sucker in waiting. Back I am hauled from well-earned obscurity, and my reputation is run through the bureaucratic meat grinder of selection. A couple of shills testify to miracles attributed to my dead self, and the next thing I know, I'm assigned a cubicle in the heavenly ranks of sainthood. What a job. No rest for the defunct occupant of the cubicle farm in heaven. All day, every day, listening to petty pleas of the tormented faithful. No coffee breaks, no holidays, no pension. As for the saints themselves, what they pray for is Armageddon and the end of life on earth. With the death of the last of those pesky humans, saints will be able to doff their headsets, clean out their desks, and gather around the celestial water cooler to swap stories about their deceased supplicants. I've been clever enough to perpetrate enough evil in my life that I should escape the heavenly hell of sainthood. A word to the wise here, live a good life, but not too good. Canada's right-wing ideologues have finally achieved a goal they pursue since the Trudeau era. The last remnants of once proud Petro-Canada will die, disappearing into the maw of Suncor Energy. No more will conservatives be taunted by Petro-Canada signs on our highways and byways, recalling a time when our federal government sought to control Canada's energy supplies for the benefit of Canada. No more will multinational oil giants be reminded of the days when our country had its own integrated energy company, willing and able to compete from exploration right through to retailing. Petro-Canada presented a clear and present danger to foreign companies operating here. If the People's Corporation could produce and sell petroleum products for a lesser price while still making a profit, it could break the oligopoly pricing, bringing in billions of dollars in excess profits. In service to Exxon, Shell, and their sisters, Brian Mulroney gutted Petro-Canada, finally selling it off. Now its signs stand in silent mockery of Canadian nationalists as we cruise by, noting its posted prices, identical to the mill with those of the rest of the oligopolistic monsters. R.I.P. Petro-Canada and our nation's dreams of a national energy policy. The pending sale of Petro-Canada illustrates a point I've made often enough. Those in power, both governments and the private sector, do not see rules and laws as policies to be adhered to. They view them as impediments to their freedom of action to be circumvented or, if necessary, changed. When Mulroney saw fit to destroy Petro-Canada as a public property, he opted to flog it off as a going concern to private buyers. A large sector of society was outraged by disposal of this carefully built and expensively assembled oil company, which we collectively own. As a sop to this public, the government of the day passed the Petro-Canada Public Participation Act, mandating that no individual entity could own more than 20% of the company's voting shares and that the head office must remain in Calgary. This act prevents any takeover, as it would violate the 20% rule. what to do. Suncor and Petro-Canada executives see this legislative impediment as an obstacle which they must, in their words, stick-handle their way around. The law is not to be followed, but circumvented. Harper's Conservatives, ever at the beck and call of the oil industry, could be called upon to repeal the Petro-Canada legislation. Failing that, it suggested that this section not be billed as a merger, but as an acquisition of Suncor by Petro-Canada. This would take some stretching, but that's what lawyers are for. It might be a hard sell as it is Suncor that's offering its own stock in the takeover, and the merged entity will be called Suncor. But the point is illustrated. Rules are made to be broken by those with the power to break them. As for you and me, we'd better walk the line or pay the penalties. Based on a brief visit to British Columbia in 2007, California's Governor Schwarzenegger is extolling our province's public-private partnerships. Arnold was given a tour of Vancouver's Canada Line construction site, a pep talk by Gordon Campbell. Now he's back in California, advocating that his state emulate us by funding capital projects through P3s. Some may question Arnold's acting abilities, but no one accuses him of being stupid. So what's behind his following statement? Quote, "It's like when you look at British Columbia or other places where they have a public-private partnership, where everyone is happy, businesses are happy, the people are happy, labor is happy, the politicians are happy. I mean, everyone is happy. We want to do the same thing. We should. The United States should copy that kind of principle so that you can get out there and build." Close quote. A quick visit, a pitch from our premier, and Arnold is able to declare that over 4 million British Columbians, every single one of us, is happy with this scheme to defray and inflate costs of infrastructure projects. It's a wise man who can make such an extrapolation, or a cunning and desperate man. Independent studies reveal that P3s merely defer costs to the public while adding a hefty surcharge for private profit. So why is Arnold so enthusiastic for these ripoffs? California is in bad financial straits. It's tapped out with decreasing tax revenues, rising expenses, and huge debts. What to do? By opting for P3 schemes, costs of public projects are passed to future taxpayers. Payments are guaranteed to corporate builders and maintainers of bridges, schools, and hospitals. Future outlays aren't carried on public books as debts, but will be recorded in the future as expenses. The financial effect is exactly the same as public debt. It's the bookkeeping that's different. Arnold sees P3s as an escape hatch, a temporary one, a way to stimulate the state economy, patch crumbling infrastructure, hide the costs, and please those with money to invest in future streams of guaranteed income. California's move to public-private partnerships has nothing to do with keeping its citizens happy, as all of us in British Columbia are. It's an act of desperation. The unhappiness will rest with future generations of Californians paying the deferred costs. Those who wish to add stimulus to the economy would do well to obtain a copy of the latest Hedonics catalog. This company claims modestly that it sells really neat stuff. For instance, for a mere $39.99, not $40, plus $9.95 shipping and $2 GST, a total of $51.94, you can have delivered to your door this bargain. It's a fire starter kit consisting of 10, quote, natural, sustainably harvested Minnesota Ponderosa pine cones dipped in candle-grade wax scented with essential oils. These $5.19 pine cones come in a basket of 100% recycled paper pulp at no extra cost. Such a bargain. For just over $5 a crack, you can save newspaper and kindling that you might otherwise waste in torching your fireplace. If that opportunity doesn't itch your check-writing fingers, try this one. For a penny short of $90 plus $10.95 shipping and GST, you can own a drink caddy. This is a phony club you stick in your golf bag, concealing liquid and having an electric pump to dispense your drink, hot or cold, batteries not included. It gets better. There is a solar-powered floating fountain for your lily pond at $70 plus, or a waistband stretcher for tubbies at $40, a magnetic coaster that ages wine in 30 minutes for just $50, a mouse pad handcrafted of top quality leather for $35, a leather condom case, no kidding, for $25. Here's my favorite. This is a must-have item for those who have not come to terms with our new measurement systems. It's a bathroom scale which, for only $60 plus, gives your weight in stone, as well as those newfangled pounds and kilos. Don't laugh. When in Australia, I gave my weight in pounds and the locals were perplexed. They still use stone. When I worked in a warehouse there, the weight of heavy items was listed in tons, quarters, stone, and pounds. No wonder the country embraced the metric system. Once upon a time, there was a middle-aged couple who owned a goose. This goose laid a golden egg every day like clockwork. One day, the man killed the goose, and his wife roasted the bird, giving them a fine dinner, stuffing for pillows, and lots of leftovers. They lived happily ever after on the proceeds of investing the accumulated gold in bonds. The moral is that some people know when they have enough. This is rare today. Even Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, both wealthy beyond our comprehension, cannot give up the chase after that next billion. Neither has enough. Only now are average North Americans beginning to cut back on luxuries out of fear or necessity. For years, millions spent every penny and then some, borrowing for expensive toys, oversized homes, fancy cars, and exotic holidays. If that's the way one chooses to live, there will never be enough. One day, retirement or unemployment may come with the shock of realizing that a much reduced income and no savings won't support that lifestyle. The next time you meet this person, he or she may greet you with, "Will you have fries with that?" You may know someone who bucks the trend, living modestly in a smaller home, driving an older car, and avoiding purchases of unneeded junk. He or she saves money without gambling on the stock markets and, when retirement time comes, takes off on a cruise. The difference between this person and Bill Gates is not so much the bank balance, but the concept of enough. It's a lesson often learned too late. I read that those linked Olympic rings represent the five continents. They also have names, supposedly representing the virtues of these international contests. They are, according to the Olympic Committee, passion, faith, victory, work ethic, and sportsmanship. Now there's a grab bag that could have only been the compromise cooked up in a committee. I suggest that a more suitable designation for these circles would be waste, greed, gullibility, debt, and steroids. These biennial exercises are a waste of resources, a greedy feeding frenzy of athletes and corporate sponsors, gullibility of those spending real money to watch stage performances, a sinkhole for debt as a legacy to cities, and a struggle of athletes to hide the use of steroids and other substances that will enhance performance without leaving traces. Within a year, British Columbia's fog of enthusiasm will dissipate as everyone goes home and we survey the wreckage of a big party. For all of us, it will be government debt and the realization that great promises of fame and prosperity were hollow. The hangover will be fierce, especially if the world recession, depression, is still with us. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. In October of 2010, there will be another election. This one will not be an opportunity to unseat our federal conservative minority, more's the pity. This will be a poll of members of the UN's General Assembly to choose a temporary member of the Security Council. Stephen Harper is pulling out all the stops in a campaign to have Canada selected. In this contest, each UN member nation has one vote, so Belize carries as much weight as Russia or France. Canadian officials have been ordered to lobby for our membership everywhere they can. They'll buttonhole delegates to the G20 meeting, at NATO's 60th anniversary celebration, at the Summit of the Americas, at the IMF World Bank get-together, and with the G8. They've been told to emphasize our grand Vancouver Olympics as a showcase of Canada's heft. Harper's regime will use the Olympics itself as an opportunity to lobby participating nations. People called fluffers are assigned to curry favor with national representatives, each with a targeted strategy and an intelligence file. Big deal. I'm not surprised at Harper's emphasis on splash over substance. It typifies his reign. Temporary membership on the Security Council is merely symbolic, as real power is held by the five permanent members, the only ones with vetoes. Even with the Olympics going for us, it'll be difficult to garner national votes. Look at Canada's performance from a foreign perspective. We fall far short of promised goals for foreign aid. We're shifting our meager aid from Africa to Latin America, so there goes a swarm of African votes. We're embarrassingly loyal to every action and crime of Israel, so that's the end of prospects for Middle Eastern support. We counter international efforts to curb environmental pollution by allowing increases under intensity-based standards. We crow that we needn't carry our weight in restoring economic equilibrium, as we'll be the first nation to recover, and to hell with the rest. We remain an enthusiastic participant in America's coalition of the killing in Afghanistan, a coalition reluctantly joined by some NATO members who feared George Bush's wrath if they refused. We've damaged our credibility as a nation of laws when our national police force lies its way out of culpability for Zakansky's death in the airport designated as the main entry point for international visitors to our Olympics. We refuse to repatriate one of our own citizens stranded in Khartoum. And to top it all, we keep electing, albeit with a minority, a party embracing a crew of wooden, self-serving scumbags. Do we care whether Canada wins an ineffectual seat on an organization wherein our vote doesn't count? I think not. Not while we have our current government as an embarrassment. Some time ago, British Columbia's beloved Liberal government proposed to sell off our liquor stores. Alberta did this a few years ago, resulting in proliferation of retailers, making Alberta's downtowns resemble American cities with liquor stores on every block. These private stores have been a boon to Albertans, ones who own the stores anyway, not so good for their non-union minimum wage employees or citizens concerned by increases in alcoholism. Public reaction in BC to the prospect of privatization was immediate and violent, forcing Liberals to pursue their project by stealth. This is akin to their cunning methods of undermining BC Hydro and other Crown assets. It's just that the process is more visible. Rules were changed so that pubs, formerly allowed to sell beer over the counter by the case, could open cold beer and wine outlets. Once these things had sprung up, they were allowed to add hard liquor to their stocks. According to a government liquor store employee, these private liquor outlets buy their supplies from the public wholesaler at a deep discount, then turn around and sell their booze at a hefty markup, mostly after hours when real liquor stores are closed. As society worries about increases in youth alcoholism, these private outfits are tempted to sell to all comers, as their only goal is profit, divorced from any public purpose. I see that both Kamloops and Prince George have closed many real liquor stores as private ones proliferate. Here in Prince George, we have one main store, dubbed a signature store, and two satellite outfits. I assume this is the pattern throughout the province. If our main liquor store is a signature store, would this imply that these rip-off scab outfits are forgeries? Military recruiters in British Columbia have a new enticement to offer fresh potential cannon fodder. They can assure eager young applicants that being a soldier in Afghanistan is safer than being a snowmobiler in our back country. We've buried over 20 of the latter in the last year, while our fighters are statistically safer riding around on mined roads. Our Prime Minister promises to get tougher on crime, especially gang crime. Mandatory sentences, no more two-for-one credits for remand time, more cops and cop toys. Meanwhile, his provincial accomplice, Gordon Campbell, is cutting funds for court services and the number of prosecutors. Yes, police may arrest more miscreants, but then what happens to them? Jails can't handle them, prosecutors haven't the resources or courts to try them. The result? More plea bargains where murderers confess to a lesser crime, like maybe spitting in public, and are turned loose to laugh at the system. Our governments deny a solid truth. If you mandate something, you'd better fund it. This holds for the CBC, the Canada Food Inspection Agency, and any other enterprise, public or private. The foregoing is not to say that departments like Health Canada are not looking after the public's welfare. An example of their assiduous pursuit of protection for Canadians is their campaign to shield us from counterfeit toothbrushes. In an advisory, Health Canada declared, quote, "If an imitation is suspected, customers should stop using them immediately, as their quality, safety, and effectiveness of counterfeit products cannot be assured," close quote. What a relief to know that our bureaucrats are onto this egregious offense. Surely this has nothing to do with protecting profits of companies having an oligopoly on these expensive pieces of plastic. We have ample evidence that Stephen Harper is a control freak, brooking no criticism gladly. This is why he put his pompous hand puppet, James Moore, up to cutting the legs out from under the CBC. The nation's broadcaster failed to fawn over our great leader and praise his every decision. Wonder of wonders, Harper actually fulfilled a campaign pledge when he appointed Kevin Page as parliamentary budget officer, a position in office created to give objective assessments to federal budgets and the state of the economy. Unfortunately for Mr. Page, he's been too assiduous in his job. He had the temerity to assess the government's prospect for the economy as far too rosy. He predicts deeper deficits and slower recovery from recession than our leader would like. His penalty? The same as CBC's. He received only two-thirds of his promised funding for his office. He cannot obtain all raw financial data he needs from the finance department for analysis and forecasting. If Mr. Page should wish for the monies promised and perhaps a hefty increase, all he would have to do is cheer Harper's every expenditure and tell us that everything will be fine if we just give this prime ministerial clown the majority he covets. But I guess Kevin Page has too much integrity to be an up-and-comer in this government. I am not a crook, said the unlamented Richard Nixon shortly before it was demonstrated that he was a crook. I await a similar wail from Patrick Kinsella, a fixture in federal and provincial election campaigns of conservative types. From the looks of it, Patrick Kinsella is to an honest man as a corkscrew is to an ice pick. Information came to light that he was deeply involved in the treacherous sale of our British Columbia Railway to CN. While negotiations were ongoing, he was on the payroll of both BCR and CN, as well as being a Liberal Party campaign strategist. When a guy is wearing three hats in a contest, it's pretty sure the one he really represents is himself. As for me, when it comes time to vote in May, I won't be thinking of the ins and outs of the daily mudslinging. I'll remember the shoddy, corrupt way that Campbell sold off a valuable asset of British Columbians for a pittance after campaigning with a promise to preserve it. Campbell and Harper, like a couple of bookends. If you don't think the Queen's English is deteriorating, look at the following examples. Consider all the talk today about toxic assets. No one blinks when speaking these two words together, but isn't this an oxymoron? And I heard a news announcer on our beleaguered CBC tell the story of a man who was, quote, kidnapped against his will. As opposed to what? The gurus of our Canada pension plan are optimistic about stock markets. Those entrusted with investing umpty-ump billions of dollars of public money that will be needed to pay tomorrow's pensions have a great idea. After registering whopping paper losses on money gambled on the markets, they intend to issue bonds to the public, bonds with the highest credit rating as they are backed with our savings. Once they've sold the bonds, raking in billions and paying a handsome fee to those selling them, the residue will then be invested in stocks. Our trustees are gambling that the stock markets have bottomed and that they can leverage their way into record profits. What's wrong with this picture? Wasn't it leveraged money bet on risky investments in esoteric instruments and stocks that caused this whole global meltdown? Here's my suspicion. CPP trustees have been pressured to put public money, once removed, into stock markets to raise prices, creating confidence that the worst is over. The smacks of more desperation. It's a long shot, but if it works, officials will look like heroes. If it fails, the Canada Pension Plan will be deeper in the hole, with not enough in new speculative investments to cover bonds issued. Our public pension fund should not be used as a pot for gamblers. It ought to be limited to the safest of investments so that today's workers can be confident that pension payments await them in retirement. Let the Warren Buffetts of this world do the gambling. Last week, the world stock markets made impressive gains. Predictions for coming days are all over the map. Those who've been sitting on cash awaiting a bottom may be jumping back in, hoping for serious capital gains. Or this rise may be what speculators call a dead cat bounce or a bear rally. In that case, the latest stock rally may be another spike on the way down. Recall that after the crash of 1929, the market's minimum was not found until 1934, with many false bottoms on the way. John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail has lifted the lid of a box that many don't want to see. He speculated as to where we might go if all of Obama's unprecedented stimulus spending fails to kickstart the credit system. If the unthinkable happens, we could be worse off than if we had allowed markets to sort themselves out without interference. Today's situation is a long time in the making, as growth of the past years was not based so much on increased incomes or productivity, but on easy credit and heavy borrowing by individuals, corporations, and governments. There's a real fear of our entering into a balance sheet recession, one in which profits and wages are used not for consumption, but to pay down accumulated debt. This would be a symmetrical unwinding needed to bring economies back into balance. On a blackboard, it looks simple, but what happens to the companies and individuals whose income depends on a developed economy and a free flow of money? Those caught in this contraction won't have the incomes to reduce debt, so bankruptcies will proliferate. Trillions of dollars thrown around would then not stimulate spending to revive the economy. They would go to pay down private debt by moving that to debt of governments. When those governments eventually cut expenditures and raise taxes, as they must, they increase the long-term effects of recession, dragging it into depression. Is this concept frightening? You bet. That's why even fiscal conservatives are reluctantly supporting stimulus efforts based on deficit spending. The alternative success is unthinkable. It's desperation that prompts the Canada Pension Plan to gamble with our retirement money. If their efforts, coupled with all others, fail, the CPP could go down the tubes along with the rest of the financial structure. But don't worry, be happy, shop until you drop, and everything will be fine. A disconcerting weight is placed on the movement of stock prices as a measurement of economic health. The nominal value of shares is loosely connected to real economies, but they're not directly geared. Stock markets are usually considered to be the indicators of actual economic moves, but there's disagreement as to whether they are leading or following indicators. Does a recovering economic activity raise stocks, or do rising stocks loosen purses? Both items are largely reliant on psychology, but the psychology of different sectors of the populace. I have a hypothesis which is certainly not unique, but which remains unmentioned in any place I have reached. I suspect that stock market movements today have little bearing on buyers or sellers' guesses on the real economy. I think they're rising in recent days because of fear more than hope. There's a great deal of money now withheld from investment in stocks. It's parked in cash, money market funds, bonds, GICs, and commodities. Commodities are extremely volatile, requiring a strong stomach to deal in. As for cash, well, that's dead, earning no interest. Money markets don't keep up with inflation. Secure bonds and GICs have pathetic returns. I was recently offered a redeemable GIC yielding 0.15%. The fear that could drive stock prices up is the ever-present specter of inflation. With governments borrowing huge amounts of money, there's serious risk of reluctance to lend funds at today's pathetic rates. If the U.S. government, as the largest bond issuer, finds it necessary to hike interest rates on new issues from, say, 2% to 4%, the value of outstanding bonds will drop drastically. If those with money now in bonds suspect that interest rates may jump, they could be tempted to gamble that stocks will be more attractive bets than bonds for stable or rising values. Such a driven increase in price for common stocks would be completely divorced from the real economy, which could be simultaneously collapsing. There, at the risk of losing my reputation as a Pollyanna, are my thoughts. This has been the 308th edition of Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Uncle Don will not be held responsible for personal mental disorders precipitated by my shows.